magic. Yeah. So I'm sorry I can't be here next week. It appears that there is a very exciting program here. But anyway, I will start maybe before that and talk about what I have been working on. So I will be talking about two things. One is about the polarimetry study of supernovae, which really try to understand the details of the geometric structure of the supernova ejecta. And then I will talk about C-magic and compare it with MCLS that Saurabh Jha and Bob have been working on, and discuss this local Hubble bubble, and how what I think about the nature of that. So first, about the polarimetry, it's really, you know, it's like the photons in a supernova ejector, it's a diffusion process, so it goes out somehow from somewhere deep inside, for instance, a photon from here, and it is scattered by these electrons, and each electron scattering produces some kind of polarized light. But you know, each little photon, it's you know, it produces and a little bit to the polarization. But if you have a spherically symmetric geometry, then all these vectors will cancel. You don't get any net polarization. But the sphericity can be broken by a lot of ways. You can add a bunch of opacity anywhere, you know, just a blob of, let's say, hydrogen here. It will break the symmetry in that particular wavelength. It will absorb, and in all the other places, it may still appear to be spherically symmetric. So this you're going to see a more or less zero spectrum with zero continuum polarization, but with that blob of hydrogen, you're going to see a polarized hydrogen feature, absorption feature. But you may have continuum polarized as well. In that case, you just have an overall distorted envelope. The whole structure is distorted, like a oblate or prolate spheroid. You break spherical symmetry, you get polarization. So this is very simple, actually. Polarization can be used in a very straightforward way to diagnose the geometric structure of supernova. If this ejector is all everywhere smooth with no macroscopic chemical blobs or chemical clumps, then the geometry is smooth. But if the symmetry is broken by, you know, you have spherical symmetry is broken by just stretching the sphere to make it somewhat prolate, oblate, spheroid. Then you observe in polarized light, you plot the polarization vector on this something called a Q and a U plane, which is basically trying to plot oscillations in different directions, electric vector oscillating in different directions. So you plot that on this plane, this will draw a straight line. If it's spherically symmetric, it will be a blob somewhere in the origin. But if you break that asymmetry, you know, because you know the light, there are some wavelength dependence of the polarization. So you plot these vectors for different wavelengths, you know, it's going to be somehow dispersed. This is because you have just a very complicated opacity structure in the ejector. So your polarization in this case will be different. Different light will see different geometric structure, basically. But now if this thing has some like chemical structures, it doesn't necessarily have to be density enhancement of something, but it's just opacity of some line is different in different places. Okay, but you still have this overall structure there. So what you're going to get is still this more or less a straight line, but you're going to get considerable dispersions across that line. It just these little blobs helps breaks the geometric symmetry somehow at a smaller scale, but this is usually big enough that it can probably detect them. So this is a program that we have been working, well, this for years. We have really, thanks to the wonderful, you know, the telescope and the instruments and the ESO, it's really, we are getting very nice data. So here is an example of 2005 DF. This is a supernova we observed. Like, look at the time coverage. We are getting like from minus 12 days, almost daily, all the way to like plus 9 days. Unfortunately, later after that, we don't have enough time. We will not, you know, we run out of our TO time. We should have continued this for some time, because what you see here is really interesting. We see these velocities, you know, this is just flux spectrum. From the flux spectrum, you can see early on it is very broad, minus 12 days. So the line is getting narrower and narrower. But on the Q, this polarized vector, what you see is that at this high velocity, there is a dip in the polarization. This is a silicon 2 line. This is a, I just picked up part of a tiny part of the spectrum. We have much more information than this. So there is a little tiny absorption. Well, this corresponding to this high at this very early time. So Q vector is, there is a dip there. And in the U direction, it is flat, basically. But it's slightly below zero. It's flat. There is no feature in the U vector. And then this thing is getting shallower with time, and this part is rising. The peak, the blue, the red part is rising in strength, in polarized. You know, it's just like some symmetry. The geometric structure is like you are really seeing the geometric structure changing with time. You know, this that's because, you know, the change of optical depths, you're probing different layers. So you do see this, you see this very clearly, how this high velocity feature is polarized in one direction in early time. And on the U vector, what you see is that this high velocity feature appears to be rising in the U vector. So these bumps is coming somewhat stronger.
Is that how I had to read this plot?
This is, well, okay, sorry. So this polarization here is all 1%, but this coordinate is just plus, you know, for different dates, I overplotted them. So this is, each of these beam is 1%. Sorry. So it's, the polarization is really low, 0.5% across this.
The zero in the bottom one, the zero passed through, no, in the central bottom one,
central, yeah.
Percent.
Yeah, this is zero.
0%.
Yeah, that's 0%. So each of these yellow lines are 0%.
Negative polarization.
So here, well, I mean, we polarization, degree of polarization is always positive. That's because you sum Q squared and U squared. But polarization itself has directions. So there is a polarization, degree of polarization, there is an angle of polarization. So here, when it is negative, is on this, you know, on the QU plane, you have to register somewhere the angle. So the angle just goes to larger than two pi divide, I mean, half a pi. That's just, you know, negative just means we have a reference direction that is not really pointing to the direction of the polarization. So this Q and U, so it's basically like Q and U is like, you know, on this Cartesian coordinates, Q and U, you are having this, you know, these vectors wiggling around. So here is that, you know, for this same wavelength, for in 6,000 astron.
Sorry, if you were plotting the polarization angle on the sky, would you actually see it spinning around this time, 180 degrees?
Well, actually, well, this is to answer your question is actually we did see, you know, there is a continuous rotational polarization we're seeing for the supernova, but I didn't prepare that view graph here. I'm going to show you some Q and U plot. But you can see this thing is the different geometric structures just changing differently. But somehow, you know, it's not random. It's like there are some coherency there. It means these are not really tiny, very small scale structure. They appear to be large plumes of some kind.
Can you remind us the definition of Q and U again? I'm sorry, I'm so black. Q is the horizontal vertical one?
It depends, you know, in astronomer's definition, like Q is more or less point to the north. There you have some kind of reference direction. It's really convention. It's you can basically make it any direction. It doesn't matter. So that's the correlation of that particular supernova. I mean, we are still analyzing that data. We try to get all the photometry. You know, I try to get people to collaborate to get the photometry, because we don't have photometry for that. So now, for some reason, as you know, I moved to Texas, and then we have all of a sudden the access to the best photometry that Carnegie can observatory is taking. So we are writing a paper to include those. So we have multi-band, very nice photometry as well to go with that. It's a wonderful supernova. So here, I mean, this is another supernova. It's actually 2004 DT, and I mean, this I wrote this paper, put it on the web for a long time, and I didn't have time to revise it to publish it. So, but it's published now. So it's. This is a supernova that is you know, showing extremely high velocity. There is a second one that's 2000X that is more or less showing even higher velocity probably. But this is an extremely high velocity event, and this silicon line is extremely strong. You can see this is a very deep line, very strong line. And the silicon line is so strong that you can see that silicon two line there is also very strong. I mean, this is usually a not so strong line, but actually you can also see that, you know, this line can be usually people taken to be as calcium two line, as calcium HK is actually a silicon two line. If you do a sino fit, you're going to see this is nicely fit by silicon two line, and they're very strong if you match all these fluxes there. So you have oxygen line that is pretty strong there. That's not so often, you know, you don't have this very often in a type 1A supernova. And you have this also somewhat a calcium line. But the correlation you can see, we detected, like, you know, across these lines, they are 2%. So this is like Q and U, but I rotated this into certain directions to maximize the variance in this vector. So this PD, I call that dominant axis. So this is like, you know, I draw that ellipsoid corresponding to some kind of distribution of data points. You find the major axis for the distribution of that axis, and you extract the spectrum there. It will call we call that dominant axis, position on the dominant axis. So this is the secondary axis. So this one, you see, there are some kind of, you know, most of signal is in PD. So the other part is like random, more like not really a lot of signal there. So this is more or less like random. So we have this signal noise, you know, of this data are really very nice. So we can look in some detail. Well, yeah, for each line.
So it's, why is silicon strongly polarized and oxygen not at all?
Thank you.
So thank you very much. Yeah, Craig answered already. So we can compare these lines. We can actually see each different line, different opacity, you know, to see how they are polarized differently on different line. So here you can see this is silicon two line that you mentioned in Hawaii. This is highly polarized. Yes, it is very highly polarized. Another silicon two line, we can actually compare the same line, you know, so line from the same species to see how they polarized, whether, I mean, in the same way or in different ways. You can see the error bars here is these little green angles. So green bars, it's probably hard, but it's blurred. So you can see this, this is the polarization occurred at very high velocity. You know, the polarization of this is really above 10,000 kilometers per second. You know, this layer that's really above, of course, that it has to be above the photosphere. So it is above this 10,000 and confined in some zone. It's like a shell of something. It's confined in a certain region. 10,000, from 10,000 to about actually 25,000 kilometers per second. And it's the same for this one. It's more or less, you know, this one, there are some blends of lines, of course, you know, it's close to the calcium HK line, but it's really silicon two line. So when you identify type one, identify those calcium HK line, there is a, I think there is a serious danger when there is this strong silicon 2 line. It's very silicon 2 line at 63.55, there is a strong likelihood that the so-called calcium HK is actually from silicon. So you can see this, it polarizes really in a nice same way.
What is the meaning of any velocity 30,000 kilometers a second? That's what you say is head material at 30,000 kilometers a second?
I don't know if there is said. You can see the highest velocity. We have very high signal noise. Uh-huh. You can see how high these velocities are.
Okay, so it's
25. Maybe the maximum would be like 27. I don't think 30 is really the velocity.
Is this a maximum light you find?
Yeah, this is maximum light. Yeah. So you can see magnesium 2 line, which is here, which I think, you know, usually people, I don't know how many people identify this as magnesium 2 line. Apollo has a paper actually identify this as magnesium 2. That's probably the one of the clearest identification, you know, mark that I could find. But I think this is a magnesium 2 line. It's just, you know, it is at some very unusual high velocity. Magnesium is that, you know, it's confined in somewhat the same area, probably slightly more outward than the silicon layer, silicon feature, silicon lines. I don't call them layer yet. So there will be this oxygen 1 feature. You can see it's not polarized at all. So oxygen 1 shows no polarization. It appears in oxygen. If you look at, take a look in the oxygen light, you know, in light of this, in this wavelength range, there is no polarization. The thing is spherically symmetric, more or less.
But it's moving at the same velocities, just to make it the same velocities in total.
Yeah, but you can see the velocity again is from 10. You know, we can't find it. I mean, everything above we can observe, basically. So now we see, you know, globally, we see this global structure, you know. They have these symmetries, distorted atmosphere. But now we want to see if there are, you know, a more important question is really all these symmetries smooth or it's lumpy. So this is, in the beginning I showed that, you know, what you expect from a lumpy ejector and from a smooth ejector. There are...
Which supernova are you talking about now?
2004 DT.
Okay, good, fine.
Yeah. So which one is lumpy, which one is smooth? So this you can do this by looking at the lines, you know, by plotting on the QU diagram, which I showed in the beginning. If you see two dispersions there, then it has to be lumpy. If you don't see two dispersions, then it has to be a smooth structure. So this nowadays, you know, it's really digitized observations nowadays. So with CCD, you can do this very accurately, actually. You can try to quantify your errors with the standard star. You quantify your systematic errors, statistical errors, rather nicely with the standard star. So what you get, you just plot these data points there and make a chi-square fit. See how well you can fit by a straight line. Or you can do something more complicated, but it's more or less the same. The results will be the same. So for this particular line, we got like a chi-square per degree of freedom of 54 and 20. This is actually highly unlikely fit. No, so, I mean, it is. You see these major structures dominant the axis, but these dispersions appears to be real. And you can do this for silicon 263.55. You get again very unlikely, you know, fit. It just and then you do it for magnesium 244.81. You get a very nice fit that shows as if it is indeed smooth. So the opacity magnesium 1 appears to be ellipsoidal structure. Yeah.
If I take those plots. Phase value, I would conclude that the lower velocity silicon is more globally asymmetric than the high velocity silicon. If I look at the colors of your points, which indicate velocity,
yes.
The green ones are all down, yeah, and these are slower velocity silicon, 12,000.
Yeah.
So you would conclude that if I look, say, in a structure having the low velocity stuff more inside, that the silicon that is more inside
So
it's a more global asymmetry.
Inside, outside, yeah. So this is a
interpretation.
So this is actually, you know, we are trying. It's a very hard question to address that. We are trying to address that with multi-epoch data, but we are still. I mean, I'm still analyzing the first signal I showed. We are trying to do that. By looking at this. One thing I didn't mention here is that we don't know where the zero is.
Okay.
So we don't know that. I just put in the observe the value of the zero point, but there is an interstellar component there, which I have been so far in all our papers, we have been trying to avoid discussing that because we think, well, discussing that, well, mostly because I don't think we can determine that. Well, we have different ways to do that.
But otherwise,
none of them is good.
Make a geometrical model that you get this velocity information and they put it in the geometrical position information.
Yeah.
Make something that looks reasonable. But if there's this uncertainty, of course, you can.
Yes. So we can make some guess to discuss that, but I'm reluctant to do that. I think the correct way of doing that is to observe one that is very early, another one that is somewhat 2 weeks or 3 weeks later. Then you compare these two, you're going to see it. So the oxygen one line, on the other hand, is not polarized at all, which is the line. But it shows this, you know, it doesn't really fit to a point or a straight line. So it just it appears that, you know, these scatters may be real as well. So actually, just to add, because there is a, I don't know if I, should I tell something, should I say something about 2006X?
Sure.
Okay. Actually, most of these features are repeated.
Well, it's in draft form.
So in draft form, Nando Patat. Is writing 2006X paper, and he find, you know, most of these features actually repeated.
Qualitatively.
Oxygen was not polarized. So this is a very, you know, this message I think is very strong.
2006X.
All these are very highly polarized.
In other aspects as well.
But the point is that the zero thing is an integrated along tangential directions of physical velocity of what comes out in the zero thing.
So what you get, you know, this is, you get the slabs of you cut, you know, the ejector is, you look layer by layer, so it's a whole layer you're looking at.
The uncertainty in the zero point, because of interstellar polarization in the host galaxy or in our galaxy?
It's mostly, it's by both. We don't know, you know, them accurately enough to like, you know, 0.2% or 0.3%. You know, neither the host galaxy or our galaxy. It's just not clear. So that's why I just choose, avoid discussing that. And base all my discussions on, you know, the data that it doesn't require. The knowledge of the absolute zero point.
These points you are showing here encompass early epochs up to which point
So this is, I think it's pre-max. There was no photometry, so I don't really know. I guess it's like a week before max. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have photometry on this one. So I'm not going to talk about these details. So there is some very interesting issue here. I mean, from this, actually in that same paper we published 2004 DT, I argued that, you know, this high velocity supernova, there may be something quite special, maybe a single class of object that is, well, I mean, a class of object that has some kind of explosion mechanisms that. That could be interesting and maybe different even somehow compared to other, you know, these other subtypes of type 1A. Here I was listing these major subtypes, but they really the point I'm going to make is based on this figure. So this is, you know, there are like three high velocity supernova on this plot. You can see they appear to be very different. You know, you don't need to have a, you know, by looking at this spectrum, you know, they are different. And these high-velocity ones is actually Stefano Benetti's, you know, these are all the high-velocity gradient ones as well. So it's actually, you know, by all these, you know, they show very sharp decline of the velocity, and around the maximum. It's not surprising because these are really fast. They have to be correlated, and they indeed are correlated. So these high-velocity ones, they appear to be very somewhat different. And why it's different is really about dust there. Dust, so is it circumstellar material or interstellar material? This is a very big question here. Or are there circumstellar dust at all around a type 1A supernova? So for these high velocity ones, you can see I purposely, you know, make these very faint because they are very
because they are extinct.
So how much are they extinct? Yeah. So 1984A, which has a 84A, you probably it was David Branch. This is probably the earliest high velocity type 1A that we have ever, I know. So that it has an EB metasphere 0.45, okay, extinction above 1. Very unusual, right? And there will be 97 BP, it's actually the bluest supernova of this group that I know. So it has an EB metasphere of 0.2. And the 2050 BO, it has a EB metasphere of 0.43. Excuse me. So it is it is extinct. And 2004 DT, I don't know. I don't have the light curve, so I have no idea.
It's almost being finished the paper now.
Okay. So, this one appears not to be that red. Probably this will be different from the other ones. But 2006X, so this one, we know, it's just, it's like, you know, going down in the blue, like diving, you know, I don't have a number, but I guess at least, you know, 1 or 2 magnitudes of extinction, 2006X. So why would this all these supernovae be extinct? If there's high velocity, you know, at least most of this that I know are extinct by a huge, by a very large amount. So if they are circumstellar extinction, you don't expect this correlation. Why should a supernova, you know, explode in a certain direction have high velocity? It makes no sense. So if it's circumstellar, on the other hand, you know this association. It's natural. So I don't have answer. I just guessed, you know, this group of supernova could tell us something very quite important for supernova, type 1A supernova. So here I just grabbed a figure, you know, showing a EB minus V distribution for a number of supernova. So you can see, you know, it's very unusual to have a supernova extinct by having EB minus V of larger than 0.4. And these high velocity ones, there are like 2 or 3 already. Well, they claim they didn't, I don't know. They probably threw them out, so I don't know. So that's all about. Well, there is one more about protein. This is just so we just have a recent paper that we showed this. You know, we compared the position of the silicon 2 feature and the light curve decline rate, delta 15, and we corrected all this. You know, we don't observe them at the same on the same day, same epoch. So we have some. You know, we fitted this, you know, a relation of correlation at the across that feature with time, how that evolves with time. So then we correct everything to -4 days. We should probably do it at -6 days because that appears to be the maximum. But anyway, so we correct them to the -4 days, and then we see this, there appears to be a rough correlation between the correlation and the delta 15.
Now I saw that. in the paper in Science.
Yes.
When I looked at it, I thought there is, if you took out one point, it would look like a scatterwriter.
Yep. Yeah.
So how do you assess that in a proper statistical way?
So this is, this is
just as easy to say there's no relation.
You are right. This is yeah, but you're welcome. But so this is, but I mean, this is the nature of the plot. You can see this, you know, all these, you know, these big error bars, they actually, you know, distort your eyes a lot more than a, you know, the ones with, you know, you see this one with very small error bar here. Well, basically, if you do this spin here and compare that cluster there, it's quite significant.
But that tells you that you start with your straight line from the lowermost left point.
From here?
Yeah.
Because that's lower.
That's which type?
You cannot go below lower than zero. So it's just, you know, this is the lowest is 0% polarization. This is in absolute level.
Yeah, but.
But the physics of Phillips relation has to do with the amount of negative 56, so I don't see how this could be correlated to silicon features.
So well, this, you didn't read our paper, so it's just, you know, it's if you think, you know, how much nickel you produce, so the more nickel you produce, the more you reduce the lumpiness of the ejector, because you had to burn it more to produce more nickel. So you're going to burn, you know, wash out most of the lumps. If you have, for instance, this one, which is really the brightest one supernova, is in no polarization at all, which is basically you just washed out all the lumps by producing more nickel. So this, you can, and so the less nickel you produce, the more of the lumps that will survive. So I think we have another 2006X that goes somewhere, you know, very nicely in it.
It's the correlation.
Yeah.
It's one more.
So.
Well, I mean, it's the forward, the other point. I'm sorry. So you forgot those two outliers and just look at this thing. He's claiming there's a correlation and it fits. Well, look. So you get another slow decliner and has low polarization. That's interesting. Okay. You know, let's see. So the way to do this, you know, I mean, you fit this, you see the chi-square, and there is a, I mean, the significance of a straight line, you can easily do a chi-square fit.
I mean, by doing this, basically, you know, a straight line fit everything with no.
I think that the only line of defense, okay, against purists here, is that there's a very good reason to believe that that correlation is there, but you cannot say it is there, okay?
I will say that because, you know, I mean, I this talk was not very well prepared, I agree. The reason is, I mean, if you do, you fit the point source, a single zero, I mean, assuming no correlation, and assuming there is correlation, there is a significant difference in probability. Okay, I put it that way.
Even if you ignore the bottom point?
Well, even if you ignore that, you calculate the, I mean, the Pearson correlation coefficient, it's like a 0.9 or something for all these supernova.
Can I
ask? Depends on what statistic you want to see. Yeah.
The two real outliers, which you chose not to plot as red circles, have small error bars. What?
This one and that one?
Yeah. What does that mean?
These are very well observed supernova, unfortunately. So this is 2004 DT, which is unusually highly polarized. I don't know how that is polarized by that much.
All of them green,
So there is a, you know, there are, you know, these triangles are the original data, and then the one circle is the, you know, after corrected to -4 days. There are some date difference.
But two that you didn't plot in red, they have the smallest error bars practically.
So this is 1999 BY. So this is a subnominal supernova, which you know, which is totally different, I think, compared to all these other supernovas.
But it has the same polarization.
What?
But it has the same polarization as the other guy.
Well, 99BY, I think, you know, the ejector structure, you know, so I think it's totally different.
But you're only allowed a certain number of hypotheses at one time.
You can't
have special reasons after the fact.
I mean, I don't think, you know, I mean, just 99BY, for instance, you know, it has unusual delta M15. It goes to like 1 point, I mean, this is unusual.
If you had more of those and they look the same, that would be, you know, then you'd know.
Well, I mean, I don't have those. I don't have those.
Right. No, I think
you've got 5 minutes.
I would like to know what is the interpretation of that, yours.
What?
Your interpretation.
My interpretation is really, you know, we're going to build up this diagram. Don't worry about it. So my interpretation is that, you know, remember, we are not talking about the continuum position. Continuum position is zero. So this thing is more or less spherical overall. And these are all lines. So there's plumes, something, you know, these fairly large scale structures above the photosphere. So, and the central part is more or less spherical. That's because there is no continuum position. Okay, so I'm not going to refer to the models, because I think this next topic is more interesting than the previous one. So this is C-magic. Instead of, the difference of C-magic, you know, from all the other methods is, and instead of using the magnitude around max, or instead of plotting the light curves, they plot the, you know, counter magnitude diagrams. When you do counter magnitude diagram, you see that, you know, it's just regular. Very straightforward to fit this counter magnitude diagram. You don't need sophisticated templates or whatever, you know, all those parameters you can never control. Here you just fit a straight line, okay? The nice thing is that the straight line all have constant slopes. So you don't even need to fit a straight line. It's a straight line with a fixed slope. You just put the slope there, you're going to get, you know, the light curve fit. You got light curve fit, you get a magnitude, you know, for every straight line fit, there is a slope and an intercept. So we can use that intercept as the magnitude for distance. So this is just a way to fit light curves and use a different magnitude. Instead of magnitude and max, we use this thing. Magnitude at a certain color. So if you do the intercept, the magnitude at a color of zero. I mean, we usually choose to do it somewhere in the middle. That to reduce the, you know, systematic errors in the, I mean, otherwise you have to associate all your quantities with a covariance matrix. You can do that. So I'm going to skip that thing. So here is so this is in Sarab and Bob and Adam Riess, I mean, they have this, they discuss about the possibility of having, you know, the local universe expanding maybe faster than slightly by a little bit. It's a, as Bob said, it's a two sigma detection. So basically, you just try to compute the Hubble the constant at some, you know, at different redshift. You know, make a redshift cut in, you know, you divide it into higher and lower redshift, and then calculate the Hubble constant. Calculate their difference divided by the Hubble constant. You can see the absolute value of Hubble constant does not go into this. You're detecting the ratio of the Hubble constant given by the two beams. And there appears to be some kind of bubble there. And you can see this is actually the amplitude of this bubble. You know, this coordinate is this cut of the redshift. So it appears at about 7,700 kilometers per second. There is something like 5 or 6% the local universe appears to be expanding about 5% faster than the more distant universe. So here is the likely, you know, significance. It is most significant at this point.
Saying that the average is different?
Yeah, basically the average here is different from the average there. Okay, the ratio is different from 1, basically, to get. No, not this one yet. So we did this, you know, I did a fit. Well, we did this, you know, Bob, as they have an outlined way, but the way you can do this fit is really to do a joint fit, a three-parameter joint fit, a Hubble constant, a ratio of Hubble constant, and a redshift cut. And or the relevant, the number for, you know, the Hubble constant itself does not matter, but it goes into your fit to this curve because it shifts up and down. So you should marginalize on your Hubble constant, error of that Hubble constant. So eventually you can build up a error covariance matrix, or, you know, this error contour of redshift versus this ratio, the Hubble bubble ratio. But in this figure is actually what I want to say, that that may be relevant in understanding whether this Hubble bubble is real. So this is really from the Sarab's paper. All these data points are from, you know, the one is the residues, you know, I calculated the residues. Well, actually there was in that table. The residues on the Hubble diagram and errors also from that table. And this is the extinction they applied to the supernova. What you can see, you know, these residues, you can do a linear fit. You know, all I can do is linear fit nowadays. So,
yeah, we've seen that. Yeah.
Okay. So this linear fit. What? So you do a linear fit. What you find, you know, you can derive an equation like this. This is rather significant. The point I'm making here. All these numbers, they are, you know, they are very significant. And you can see chi-square, by having this two parameter, you have chi-square, you know, two straight line has two parameters. Your chi-square decreases from 117 to about 101. So this is like 16, degree of 16. So it's moderately significant. I'm not going to claim this is really significant until we see the difference. So this is when the Hubble, the way to deduce this, you know, marginalizing a Hubble constant and deduce the ratio, this is the error contour I derived using the same data that on the you know, Sarab's same data. And indeed, there is like a little bubble there. This is the redshift cut, 0.2 something, which corresponds to 7400 kilometers per second. And it's about 5%. So it's totally, completely consistent with what Sarab's paper talked about. So that's the red line is the one sigma error bar. Then the green line is, it didn't appear, but even I can, so it's here. So it's like slightly above 2 sigma detection, okay? But when I apply that small extinction correction, then it's really a tiny extinction correction. So this when I apply that,
throw those high extinction points.
Throw this away.
Yeah.
You know, we'll make this extinction more necessary. But let's keep going with this.
Okay.
Well, I mean, this actually, you know, it just makes this, you know, it will not flatten the line. This just helps to reduce the effect I'm correcting. Yeah, because these are the highly extinct ones. So, well, I was trying to repeat exactly what the Sarab did, okay? So what happens is that when you do that, so the bubble shifted here. There is still a little bit there, but the main peak is here. So this is one sigma error contours. It goes here. Okay? And you can see, the two sigma, this is two sigma level now is here. So it's actually one sigma there, two sigma.
Are you just showing us that at the 5% level, you can't get a distance to a supernova nearby?
5%?
That
no, I'm not saying that.
No, but if I reinterpret what you're saying, it's that there are systematic effects at a 5% level that inhibit you from making such a measure.
No. I'm just trying to repeat what's in Bob's paper, in Sarab's paper. Okay? So then I apply this, you know, there is...
You're just, I think, showing the level of measuring. This is delta H, this is the same as the distance to 5%, right? Is that at the 5% level?
No, that's not. I'm showing that an extinction correction will change everything. Change your conclusion.
No, that's, right. No one's arguing with it.
Okay. But But there, you know,
whether it's correct to do that is a separate question.
So, but one thing that is for sure, that without correcting this line, your dissonance modulus is wrong. Why it's wrong? Because your dissonance modulus should not be dependent on AV. You must remove this dependence. If you are seeing residual correlations with AV, your distance is wrong. Because distance does not depend on AV, A sub V. Okay? So this is the point I'm making. Yeah. It's not about this four supernova. It's not about this four supernova.
I'm saying it's not a little AV.
Which four supernova?
The four that for which you apply high AV, maybe there's a four.
No. I did not apply. This is that paper applied this high AV.
I understand, but I'm saying that it's also redundant with, you know, or degenerate, if you say, with our lack of knowledge about supernova likelihood.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Right. We know the relation between intrinsic color and luminosity.
Correct. Right.
That's all built in there.
Right.
So
maybe it doesn't work too well for the high rending case.
If you remove these two, you just make this effect more significant. So this is the point. You move all of this, you just make this line more steeper. You cannot make a flat line out of this cluster of data. This is what I'm saying. Your distance modulus is correlated with AV, A sub V. And that's wrong. Yeah, that has to be wrong. Yes.
Yeah, but whether it is in the analysis of the Hubble bubble, which depend on leaving out the high reddening guys.
So whether it is important, you just do exactly the same thing. You remove this line, and go to do repeat the analysis the same way. Well, I mean, you can repeat it, also remove this, but that's not what you did in the paper.
Okay.
So what you find is that the Hubble bubble really moved there, okay? And there are other ways to check this. You can randomize. You know, you can randomize all these residues, okay? Now I randomize the redshift. So I just totally destroy. This is like a bootstrapping. You know, I just construct new samples by completely destroying the observed redshift information, okay? Then I do the same fit. I apply exactly the same fit. What you can see, you know, again, now you have this bubble, you know, these little things appearing. Sometime they can be one sigma or, you know, two sigma contour is over there, so close to two sigma. So it could be even be statistical fluctuations. You know, just by doing the bootstrapping, destroying the redshift information, you get that. But, you know, this it just, of course, now the bubble appears, you know, the redshift just moves around. So you can do a simple way. You don't necessarily have to use MCLS. You can do a just simple delta M15 method. Yeah, just correct for delta M15 and correct for the, you know, you don't correct for the color. Not a, you know, here I didn't try even to reduce the extinction. You just correct for the B max minus V max color, which is the parameter that is independent of redshift. You correct for every parameter that is independent. Independent of distance, I'm sorry. So anything independent of distance should not be correlated to the residue of the Hubble diagram. So what you do that, you can see, I forgot about this part. So you have, again, so I do get a bubble here. But the significance is still less than two sigma, but it's consistent with the one, you know, using Sorab's, it's consistent with this one, at identical redshift there, okay? And of course we can, I mean, with C-Magic, the method, my favorite. So we can compare these Hubble diagrams, see how different they are. You can see, you know, here, this is a different method. You know, that's delta 15. I should plot the other one, Sorab's data point. It's more or less similar to this, almost, you know, similar. What you find is that, you know, C-Magic produces much less. well, much better Hubble diagrams. You can see how the error bars reduce and how the data points move to that line. So I think, you know, this is an indication of you know, the model appears to be successful. Yeah, I am. Okay, unfortunately, I didn't. So, I'm done. Yeah.
What about when you use your distances?
When I use my distances, I was trying to look for that wheel graph, actually.
I mean, if you have a method and you think it works better, then you should look in your relation between distances.
So my deal is the same as Datum 15, the same as corrected for. It's the same as Sirop's data corrected for, you know, this additional A sub V. It's totally consistent with that. You know, all these little error controls appear.
Right, you gotta plot them point by point and see how they agree.
Yeah.
So they do agree now.
In some, if you do the apply the residual EV correction, they are everything correct to the same. Come on, you have to correct for that.
Well, I don't know.
Okay, other questions, Craig?
Just one comment, because he put his conclusions up and then zapped them away so fast that it's relevant to what we'll talk about next week, which was that the delayed detonation works, but not very well, as I think you said.
So,
I can get my summary. I mean, we see all these things moving at very high velocities. Maybe there's a slightly weird supernova, but we think we see those high velocities in normal supernovae, and as far as I know, the published pure deflagration models don't do that. They leave too much unburned stuff on the outside. But these lumps that we're seeing in the polarization do not appear in the standard delayed detonation models either, which is where this
thing is.
Is the oxygen located at a different position than the silicon among the completely
interpretation is that the oxygen is kind of everywhere. It may be kind of lumpy, but it's more or less everywhere. It must be in between the magnesium and silicon lumps and also in the magnesium and silicon lumps.
Yeah, it has to be everywhere.
It has to be spread more or less.
And the DDT would normally wash out the chemical inhomogeneities that are left over from the deflagration, which are needed to get these lumps, seems to see.
The lumps are there.
Well, but it's the interpretation of
yeah, no, the interpretation is in the other goal.
So, excuse me.
The high polarization.
Yeah. What model are we referring to when it comes to DDT?
Oh, I don't know, Gamizos?
But those are wrong according to Volta.
Sorry?
No, those models are wrong according to Volta.
Oh, we can talk about that one. Maybe we'll be here.
But the other out the general trend of these DDTs following a deflagration phase is to wash out, to a certain extent, chemical inhomogeneities that were left from the deflagration phase. And these chemical inhomogeneities are needed to explain the line polarization.
So I don't quite understand, otherwise you're claiming that they use the method for propagating detonations that is incorrect, because that wouldn't work. So if it doesn't work, then it doesn't wash out the inhomogeneities.
I also say that I say that all the deflagration detonation detections that have been done to a different extent, but nevertheless have all the tendency, and that's independent of the numerical method that is applied, to wash out this inhomogeneity. This is natural.
Not completely.
So this is natural, because the only thing these DDT does is to move unburned stuff that is left in between burned Rayleigh-Taylor structures to something that is either, say, if density is high enough, iron group, or at lower density, silicon.
Discussion for lunch, Wolfgang.
Yeah.
Bob, did you have an announcement about any soap?
No, not yet. I will.
Okay. Great.
So,
excellent one. We're done.
This is what you want.
This is somehow the same.